You're listening to Chewin' a Yat with Chris Champagne on WAMF 90.3 FM, New Orleans, Louisiana.
Well, today we're going to have a special show. We're going to play some of the things that we've done in the past about the fairgrounds. It's going to be a tribute to the fairgrounds. Ronnie and I are going to do fairgrounds memories, and we're going to have some monologues from our racetrack show, Win, Place, and Show, with Ronnie Virgin, Larry Baron, and Chris Champagne.
Well, you know, it's November, so we've talked about this many times before, and the end of November, Thanksgiving Day, means one thing to many, many Orleanians, and that thing is
the opening of the fairgrounds.
That's right, and I know that fairgrounds has been one of our sponsors for the last several years, so I'm really grateful to that. Of course, I'm an employee over there as well, and I know that you love racetracks. So we're going to do a special Wait, Don't Shoot Me today of racetrack.
Uh-oh.
Okay? You up for that?
I'll try.
Okay. Now, I think that most of these, usually Wait, Don't Shoot Me is the New Orleans game show that tries to explain unexplainable New Orleans and Louisiana government and culture. But today, and we usually have the Louisiana education model, which means there are no right answers. But I think we're going to have right answers today.
Uh-oh.
Okay. So we'll learn a little bit about horse races, maybe. It is rumored that NFL teams were bought with assets from bets made at racetracks over the years. What are one of the teams supposedly that was paid for with bets won at a racetrack, like a big bet at the track? Of course, it would probably have to be some time ago, because it's almost impossible to win, you know, $1 billion at the racetrack. A, the New York Giants. B, the Baltimore Colts. C, the Arizona Cardinals. Or D, the Pittsburgh Steelers. Which one of those is rumored to have been bought with money won at a racetrack?
Wellington Mara's New York Giants.
Well, the answer is, that's correct. Ding, 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 ding. The New York Giants. But that's true. The New York Giants were bet supposedly with winnings, the Pittsburgh Steelers. Now, this is not necessarily true. And the Boston Patriots also. So I talked to a gentleman who knew Billy Sullivan, and he said that's how he bought the Patriots. He won a big bet at the track. Now, here's the other one. It is rumored that a racetrack owner bought an NFL team with assets from the mob. What NFL team was that? A, the New York Giants. B, the Baltimore Colts. C, the Arizona Chicago Cardinals.
I don't know. The Giants?
The Chicago Cardinals. Bidwell was evidently hooked in with, supposedly with Capone. And there was an athletic club in Chicago that started a football team. They broke off into two factions. And one bought the team, and they were supposedly with mob money. Now, I'm not saying that's true, because I'm not that old, and I wasn't there.
Okay.
What was the purse of the first Kentucky Derby? A, your weight in Evan Williams whiskey. B, $1,000 added. Or C, $150 in gold.
$150 in gold.
$1,000 added. It was run for $1,000. What year was the first thoroughbred horse brought to America? Officially, A, 1730, B, 1751, C, 1703.
I don't know, 1751.
1730. When was the first race course laid out in Kentucky? Now, before this, they used to just run, wherever they could, in the field or down the street and everything. A, 1789, B, 1792, or C, 1759.
1792.
1789. You're close.
Yeah.
Who was among the men who organized this track? A, Jack Daniels. B, Daniel Boone. Or C, Henry Clay. In other words, there was a group of people that organized the racetrack that was first built there. It was a group of, you know, citizens of Kentucky.
Clay, I guess.
Henry Clay. Henry Clay was the Kentucky Jockey Club or whatever it was. I mean, horse racing used to be a big deal in New Orleans. I mean, in the turn of the century and before. You know, I mean, they had five racetracks running at one time, I think in the early 1900s. It's a different world, huh?
Mm.
The Woodlawn Vase, a trophy given to the champion of Woodlawn Racecourse in Louisville, sat out the Civil War. Where did the trophy sit out the Civil War? A. Hidden inside of a church altar. B. It was sent to Canada for safekeeping. C. It was buried in the ground for safekeeping on the track itself.
I'll go C.
That's right. It was buried during the Civil War, so nobody would steal it. And a replica of that trophy, a half replica of that trophy, half the size, is given every year to the winner of the Preakness.
Ah, okay.
The Woodlawn Vase. Who was there to witness the only horse disqualified in Kentucky Derby history? In other words, Dancer's Image was disqualified before when Passes made the winner. And there was a famous person who happened to be at the track that day. A. O.J. Simpson. B. Richard Nixon. C. Roman Polanski. Or D. Spiro Agnew.
Spiro Agnew.
Richard Nixon. Nixon was there. The only time a horse was disqualified, Nixon was in the stands. Who was the most prominent person ever to attend the Kentucky Derby, according to the Kentucky Derby people? A. Chris Champagne. That would be me.
Okay.
B. Queen Elizabeth II. C. Ali Khan. D. The Shah of Iran. Or E. Tamerlane the Great.
D.
Queen Elizabeth II.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I said?
Queen Elizabeth II.
Yeah.
Ding, 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 ding. Okay. What jockey has the most lifetime wins in history of thoroughbred racetracks? A. Billy Shoemaker. B. Lafitte Pincai Jr. Or C. Russell Bayes.
Pincai.
Russell Bayes. Got over 12,000. It blew him away. Now, one more question on racetracks. Who is the 22nd leading trainer in history in the United States? I'm going to give you a chance. Okay. A. Hal Bishop. B. Bernie Flint. Or C. Tom Amos.
Tom Amos.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. Tom Amos is 21st, but 22nd is Bernie Flint. I thought that's pretty interesting. Bishop is 29th, because that was a while ago. Bill Mott is number 7. And Asmussen is 2nd.
Who?
Asmussen.
Uh-huh.
And Van Berg is 4th.
Well, I knew a few of those gentlemen.
Yeah, I know you do. Yeah. Brett Calhoun is 30th. He'll probably catch Bishop, who's 29th. I don't have the numbers, but anyway, I mean, Louisiana racing is, you know, it's pretty well represented.
It's been around a while.
It has been, but it's pretty well represented around the country. People who are from here and were based here and, you know, have made their mark, considering the size of our population compared to, you know, other places.
Yeah.
You know, jockey-wise especially as well, but the trainers don't get as much ink.
No.
As the jockeys do. All right, well.
I thought I would have did better on that. That thing, you had some hellacious questions there, brother.
Well, I mean, they were way well before our time. I mean, I was in 1789, I was only in the second grade. You know what I mean?
That's
so
true.
So, I mean, I couldn't remember all that stuff. You know, $1,000 added. Kentucky Derby, huh? That's worse than an Evangeline in 1967. Okay? All right, thanks, Ronnie. Well, I mean, the track, well, before we go, I mean, the track is, less than 2 weeks away from the beginning. They're gonna start on the 15th this year.
Mm-hmm.
So it is upon us.
Yes.
Again. And
and you'll be selling lots of winning tickets, right?
I will. And
a few losing tickets.
Yeah, you know, the fairgrounds is such an integral part of our culture and our urban landscape here. It's certainly ensconced in an old mid-city neighborhood, you know, by the park, by the bayou, on Esplanade Ridge, and it's pretty conveniently located. If you're a high roller or even a low roller, and you come to the French Quarter, which you usually do. I mean, it's 5 minutes by car down Esplanade, easy, you know, and even by bus, it's easy to get to. So it's probably one of the more accessible racetracks now in America, yeah, as far as, you know, just for the normal, for the public to get to.
And at one time, City Park had a...
Yeah, had a racetrack, yeah. I think, see, the old New Orleans, a long, long time ago, before we were even conceived, had as many racetracks as they have streetcars now. Because soon, in New Orleans, every person in New Orleans will have their own streetcar. And in those days, every person had their own racetrack.
There you go.
So, thanks for playing the Wait, Don't Shoot Me, the special racetrack edition. Thank you, Ronnie.
Loved it.
Bloodlines are a big thing at the racetrack. Who's the sire? Who's the dam? His mother runs good in the slop. Means his mother runs good in the off-track, in the rain. Big money is spent on breeding thoroughbred horses in this country. That's the retirement plan that I want. Secretariats. The finest fillies in the world, and whenever you have sex with them, you get paid $100,000. Now, people have bloodlines, too. And like I said, my mother, Miss Elsie, and my dad, Ed, both became institutions at the fairgrounds, even if I do say so myself. And I do. My mother, the lady that picked the tow sheet, the lady that whenever she opens her mouth, she creates laughter and joy. She's a natural. You'd be surprised how many people at the racetrack every day ask me about her, even though she hasn't been there for a while. At a Christmas party at the fairgrounds once, there was a kid who used to cut my neighbor's grass. He was now in the marketing department. I went over to his table to introduce myself to him, and I told him that I was Miss Elsie's son. And the whole table erupted, "Oh, we love Miss Elsie." I asked one of the girls to dance, and I'd say 5 minutes, 10 minutes tops. We were off to her place. Is my mother cool or what? Now, my father's story is a little bit more complex. Now, the first thing I have to say is I wouldn't be able to tell these stories if he was still alive because he was old school. Didn't like to tell tales out of class. He was a big, strong, tough, athletic guy. He was an All-American football player at LSU. He played for the Los Angeles Rams in the NFL as well. His pro football career ended when he broke his neck in the first half of a football game, and he played the whole rest of that game with a broken neck. He was always kind to me. He always did everything he could possibly do for me. He was an honorable man who lost his positions at racetracks many times because he believed in going by the rules. A lot of people at the track are averse to the rules, especially if they apply to them. And he'd just tell me, "Chris, that's just human nature." A friend of mine at the track once told me, "You know, Chris, I wear the black hat, you wear the white hat. And you know, if your dad would play along around here, he'd be a pretty big guy." And I told my dad that, and he laughed. He said, "You said that?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I think I'm a pretty big guy around here anyway." And so he was. Now, he got a job as a patrol judge, a placing judge, worked his way up the officialdom hierarchy, and got jobs as a racing official all over this country. Assistant racing secretary, but mostly as a steward. Now, a steward is the judges of the track. They enforce the rules. And you know, if you're the guy who has to enforce the rules, sometimes, you know, you don't win too many popularity contests. And before I delve any further into this, there's one other thing I'd like to say, though. Now that he's gone and I have occasion to see people at the track who I think may have known him, had some dealings with him, I'll introduce myself to them, or sometimes they'll come up to me and introduce themselves to me. And over half of them have told me this: "You know, your dad was a real gentleman." Now, I know there are some people who had to deal with him from time to time who would probably take issue with that. But I would like to submit that most of them wouldn't know a gentleman if he bit him on the ass. Now, the first thing somebody asks you about the racetrack when they find out you work there is whether or not it's crooked. Well, you know, being an honest man myself, I really don't know. But let me share a few episodes of one New Orleans boy's career as a racing official. My dad, a guy who was just trying to do his job. 1964, he was named director of racing and chief handicapper at Arlington Park in Chicago. I played golf with Willie Shoemaker that summer. He beat my brains out. Now, there was a trainer named Charlie Whittingham who became a prominent trainer in America who was up there at the time, and he had a big horse up there, and my father put 138 pounds on it, on his horse. He didn't like that. So he went to the lady that owned the place, and she was averse to the rules as well, and she called the printer and had the weight changed. So my dad got wind of it, and he called the printer, and they changed the weight back, and the weight stood, and the horse won the race, but only by a nose. Now, when my dad was a racing secretary, he had a rule. Whenever they were taking entries in the morning, nobody was allowed to come behind the counter except the officials who were doing their work. Now, if you go and take you're taking entries in the morning at a racetrack, the racing secretary's office is a hubbub of trainers, jockeys, owners, hangers-on. And This particular day, there was a guy named Leroy Jolly, who also became a prominent trainer in America, and he was behind the counter, and my dad told him he had to leave. And he said, is that so? And he said, yes, it is. He said, you know the rules. You can't be behind here, and you leave. And what my dad would do when somebody went behind the counter is he would just stop business and just look at them, and they would have to leave. So Jolly said, well, I'm going to go get my dad. So my father said, well, go get him. Now, at that time in Arlington, there was a guy, a legendary New Orleans character from horse racing also, known as Bundle Boy. And he was racing there that day, and he took a $100 bill out of his pocket, and he slapped it on the counter, and he said, when Jolly comes back, if he does, that $100's on champagne. Now, in good time, me, Jolly, Leroy's father, another name you might remember from horse racing in America, came in and said, I hear you had some words with my son. And he said, yes, sir, I did. He was behind the counter where you are right now. He knows the rules, and so do you, and you have to leave. He said, is that so? He says, yes, sir, that's so. Now, you got to understand, everybody at the racetrack is a cowboy. Everybody's a tough guy. So he says, well, if I don't leave, what are you going to do about it? He says, I'm going to count to two. And I'm going to throw you out that door. And I'm not going to open it. Well, he left. Easiest $100 Bundle Boy ever made. 1966, Evangeline Downs. My dad was named State Steward. It was the first season of Evangeline. During that rambunctious summer, my dad and the other stewards caught the horsemen cheating. Doping the horses, using illegal equipment, had confessions on tape. The last day of the meet, they had a rumor going around that they had hired somebody to kill my father, shooting. So my dad, my mom, she loves this. And Mr. Ronnie, one of the other stewards, also an honest guy, had a police escort, state police escort, all the way home from Lafayette. Now, as the allegations adjudicated them through the process, Mr. Ronnie and my dad had an occasion to go see the governor about this issue. The governor refused to see them. The next day, they went to see the attorney general, and he saw them. And this is what the attorney general of the state of Louisiana told my dad, Mr. Ronnie, in his office in Baton Rouge. He said, Ed, Ronnie, you know, Louisiana is full of crooks, and I'm one of them. So my dad looks at Ronnie, and Ronnie looks at my dad. He says, you know, what shot do we have here? Now, so you just so you won't think this is just a Louisiana phenomenon, because it most certainly is not. Let's go up to the great Northeast, to Howard Dean's wonderful state of Vermont, where my dad was a state steward twice. Now, the general manager of that track was a nice Italian boy from New Jersey. Not that there's anything wrong with that. And he came into the office and he said, you know, Ed, he says, you know, you're a nice guy. He says, and you know, we don't want to have to break your arms and legs. So I said, hey, whoa. He says, let me stop you right there. He says, let me give you some advice. He said, man, don't break my arms and legs. You better kill me. Because if you break my arms and legs, you see, they'll get better. And when they do, I'll come find you and I'll kill you. And he goes, oh, I didn't mean it like that. So, oh, how'd you mean? That's a term of endearment. Now, once during my father's fall from grace, he was summoned to a racetrack owner's office for a one-question interview. Thank you for coming, Mr. Champagne. If I were to put you back in the stand as a steward, and my horse won the race, and he had followed another horse, and there was an inquiry, and I called you up and asked you not to do that for me, would you do that? And he said, no, sir, I would not. He said, thank you, Mr. Champagne, that's all I wanted to know. Well, he got that job. And a friend of his from high school, a guy he used to know, who was alleged to be somewhat soprano-like, said, you know, EJ, we're glad you got that job. People who knew him when called him EJ. Said, EJ, we're in this business, and we want it run right, and we know nobody can get to you. Now, you couldn't have horse racing without a lot of human effort, from millionaires to homeless people and everything in between, and somebody to enforce a rule once in a while. Now, according to some people, evidently, Louisiana is supposed to be full of crooks, but Louisiana is also teeming with a lot of hardworking, honest people, many of whom play and work at the fairgrounds. And gladly are my friends. Now, my father's funeral, a guy who we had played high school football with and also played with him at LSU, a guy who my dad had talked about many times, but I never really knew him, never met him, came up to me and told me, your father was a good man. And then he stopped, and in an almost shy, apologetic way of men of that generation who have a hard time expressing themselves, he said he was a very good man. Now, when all was said and done, that's all's got to be said about anybody, I think. But there's one other thing that my father gave me. I have always known, all of my life, that my father loved me with every ounce of his heart. And as George and Ira Gershwin would tell you, you can't take that away from me. So anyway, thank you, thank you. Thanks. Anyway, when it comes to bloodlines, I ain't got no excuse.
Listen to WAMF FM New Orleans 90.3 on your radio dial.
The phone rings, and I open one eye to look at the clock. 7:07 a.m. I close my eye and try to think who would be calling me at 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning. It was Clay. Larry, how much money you got in the house? Figured he's in an all-night card game or something like that. I said, I don't know, $400. Why? I'm picking you up at 11. I got a horse at the fairgrounds. Can't miss. Man, the thing you need to know about Clay is that he's an expert. You know what an expert is, right? This guy knows everything possible about a given field and spends the entire day reminding you of that fact. At a very early age, Clay learned that his given field in life was going to be hanging around racetracks. The single most expensive education in a given field in the history of mankind, Clay probably could have put himself through Harvard 10 times over on the money he's blown at racetracks. And me, I got a policy. Always go with the expert. He picks me up at 11, we're riding out of the track, going down Canal Street, we stop at the cemeteries. He goes, look at the license plate on that car up ahead of us. 777-777, Louisiana, Sportsman's Paradise. He goes, that's funny, because we're gonna bet the seven all day long today, except in the seventh race. Because in the seventh race, the 11 is going to romp. Looked out the passenger window, and next to a Nopsey bus, had a big ad, must have been for a casino on the side. Three big red sevens. I didn't even think much about it at the time. We get to the track, we pay to go up in the clubhouse, and when you go to the clubhouse, they have a little sticker they stick you. You put it on your lapel, put it on your shirt, your blouse, your purse, whatever you want, but it's a little sticker, and it's marked with the day of racing. Because heaven forbid you should go in there and gamble and blow a lot of money without paying the $4 admission fee. Okay? I looked down at my little sticker, and we're there on the 77th day of racing. We ride upstairs, his friends have a box. Hey, how you doing? Smitty, get over here. Bring us some corned beef sandwiches. I need a Heineken to drink. Clay, what you want to drink? Give me a 7-7. Now, I didn't go to no Aloysius or nothing. All right? But someone is trying to tell me something here. And I don't know if it's Nostradamus, or perhaps my great uncle Milton, who was known to have spent a lot of time at the track, or maybe even God. But I've mentioned this to Clay. And Clay looks at me and goes, Larry, when was the last time God contacted you directly? I admit, never. Larry, what then are the odds that on the first time the Almighty has decided he needs to talk with you, it's going to be because he wants to give you a horse running at the fairgrounds on a Sunday afternoon? Well, this made a lot of sense, but in retrospect, I should have known that when Clay started making sense, something was up. We bet the seven in the first race. We bet the seven in the second race. There's a good chance those horses are still running to this day. It's time to make a bet in the third race. Clay gives me his ticket to cash. I go up there. The clerk counts the money, hands it over to me, and says, Red Grange. I said, come again? Red Grange? What's that mean, Red Grange? He goes, no. Red Grange, the football player. And he points at the screen on the totalizator. I look at it, $77. He goes, Red Grange wore number 77 on his jersey. I said, well, that's before my time, but thank you very much. Turn around, I'm counting the money. The guy who was behind me is at the counter now, and the clerk tells him, Mickey Mantle. Now, I'm 48 years old, and I don't need anybody to tell me that Mickey Mantle wore number 7 on his Yankees jersey, okay? Go back up to the clubhouse, sit down with Clay, tell him about this, Larry. Clay, Larry. Me, I go with the experts. It's time to bet on the next race. I'm standing in line, and the next clerk in the next line, the man tells the clerk, 401, gives him the money. I get up to my clerk and just ask him, what was that, 401? What's that about? He says, well, that's like track speak. That's slang. You know, if you're calling a bookie, you don't want to stay on the line a long time. You might be tapped. So you just have this kind of code, and you say 401. And what that means is, in the fourth race, I want the number one horse. And he looks at me and says, try this, 707. And I looked at him and I said, seventh race, seven horse? He goes, yeah. Thank you very much. Go upstairs and tell Clay about this. Larry. Me, I go with the expert. Time goes by, and with approximately 7 minutes to post time for the seventh race, we're sitting up there. And if you've been to the track, you know what I'm talking about. In the middle of the infield, there's a gigantic, what they call the tote board, perhaps 200 yards long, covered with numbers like a scoreboard, except that it's track stuff. So we have odds in the next race, horses, last weight race, win, place, and show, payoffs, other tracks around the country, handle. All this different information is flashing up on this scoreboard. And we're sitting there, and suddenly, evidently, there's a computer malfunction or something because the numbers all flash once, and then they turn, every number on the board turns to 7. Not 1-2, not 1-3, not 1-4, not 1 anything except 7. Like 1,000 sevens. Like I said, this thing is 200 yards long. I bet if I had time to, there's 1,000 sevens. I bet if I had time to count, though, there was 777 sevens up on the board, okay? All I did was look at Clay. Larry. It's time to go make our bet. We have $700 between us. We're standing in line behind a man who apparently works for 7-Up Bottling. This day and age, you never know, but apparently he works for 7-Up because his shirt and pants match and they are covered with the number 7. Okay? Next to a guy with an Elway jersey, next to a guy with a Morton Anderson jersey. And I'm standing there thinking while it's waiting for our turn, and I think to myself, I'm standing here on July 7th, 1977, the 77th day of racing, a day which will go down in history as the entire universe, every force of nature having bombarded me with the number 7. And I'm standing in line waiting to bet $700 on the 11 horse in the 7th race, which is going off at 40-1 when the 7 horse is, oddly enough, going off at 7-1. And I think to myself, I must be crazy. But we got a little time, and I think about it again and decide, no, I am crazy. And now it's our turn to step up to the counter, which we do, and give the guy the $700 and tell him we want the 11 in the 7th. And he hands us the ticket, and Clay snatches the ticket out of the guy's hand and holds it up to him like this, and he goes, now this is where the expertise comes in. Because you see, the word 7 and the word 11 sound a lot alike, and it's possible he didn't hear you. You didn't speak correctly. So you have to check the ticket before we leave this counter. And with a lot of flourish, Clay holds the ticket out, and sure enough, the guy misunderstood me. And he gave us $700 to win on the 7, which Clay corrects with probably 7 seconds to post time. Clay corrects and has him put the $700 on the 11. So we take that ticket now. And we go upstairs, we're hurrying. I'm firmly convinced that in the time it takes to run this race, we're going to have lost $700. We sit down and they break the gate. And it's very apparent early on that this is going to be a two-horse race between the 7 and our 11. They go down the back stretch, and there is enough electricity going through my body to have powered every electric train in New York City 1958 Christmas morning. They make the turn and come down the stretch, and make no mistake, it is a very long stretch at the Gentilly Oval. And here they come, the 7 and 11, nose and nose, head and head, short neck and short neck, neck and neck, heart and heart, hoof and heart, hoof and hoof, heart and heart, neck and heart, short neck and heart, head and heart, nose and heart, the heart being mine. Because it's about to jackhammer its way through my ribs and out of my chest. And they go by us. And just as my head is about to pop off my shoulders like a champagne cork, they hit the wire, and the 11 wins! I am lying on the pretty pink carpet of the Fairgrounds Clubhouse like a deboned chicken. Because it takes no strength, my head lolls back, and I see that Clay has apparently jumped high enough to set the world high jump record. It seems like it takes him a minute to come back to the earth. But when he does, he stands over me and says, Larry, we just won 28,000 scooties! I jump up. We're laughing, patting each other on the back. Ronnie was there. He told me afterwards, he said, y'all look like the apostles cutting up when Jesus showed up after 3 days in the tomb. We're dancing around, yelling. We're just about to take our traditional horse and rider ride around the clubhouse. When suddenly Clay freezes and a look comes over his face. My back is to the track, and I turn around because this is not a good look on his face. I turn around slowly, hoping that I'm going to see something fairly pleasant, like, say, Godzilla stepping on people's houses in Gentilly. I turn around and look at the tote board, and sure enough, our 11 is in win, the 7 is in place, but the numbers are flashing. Which means perhaps there has been an objection, or perhaps there has been a foul, but certainly there has been an inquiry, and as the man on the PA system reminded us repeatedly for the next 7 minutes, please hold your tickets, these results are not official. So we wait and sit like zombies for the next 7 minutes, and to make a long, painful 7 minute story short and painful, they put the 7 up in win and disqualify our 11. I was numb. Clay was disconsolate. I had, however, made a small side bet of my own. So I went and cashed my ticket for $68. And now it's time to go. We are walking through the parking lot, and in the eternal postmortem of the racetrack gambler, Clay looks at me and says, Larry, you were right. Someone or something was trying to tell us something. I should have listened to you. We walk through the gate out there by Whole Foods, and that's when the crazy thing happened. Because just then, a man wearing an Edwin Edwards for Governor t-shirt stepped from between two parked cars as we walked down the sidewalk, took a gun out and stuck it in our face and said, "Give me that goddamn money." I looked at Clay. Clay looked at me and said, "Give him the money." Me, I always go with the expert. So I forked over the $68. Now, I said that was the crazy thing, but that wasn't the crazy thing. Next thing I know, Clay has begun to joyfully dance and laugh in place. Almost as much as in the clubhouse, he's now cutting up. Now, I know he's a squirrel, but I have to ask anyway, what in the hell is the matter with you now? And he looks at me and said, "Larry, don't you see? This is the luckiest day of our lives. If we had won the 28,000 Scooties, he still would have robbed us." This guy just got screwed. I mean, the Lord really does work in mysterious ways. Let's go get something to eat. And me? I hate telling this story.
Hey,
all right, bro.
You're listening to Chewing a Yacht with Chris Champagne on WAMF 90.3 FM, New Orleans, Louisiana.
The streets of America may not be paved with gold, but money does fall out of the sky sometimes at the fairgrounds. The track is a place where you could create wealth without any capital investment. You could be a tout. You don't have to even know anything to get people horses. You just have some belief of the general public that there is some information to be had and someone has access to it. Now, certainly, sometimes this information does exist, but the chaos of the universe does not allow it to have a clearinghouse. This is a marketplace of folly. Now, every year at the track, there are thousands of dollars worth of winners that go uncashed. And after a certain interval, the money goes back to the state. How much money are we talking about? A couple of years ago at the fairgrounds, a little guy that works there at a clubhouse came up to our windows with three tickets that were soaking wet. Now, these are very fragile pieces of paper, and they won't fit into the machines if they're wet. So they have a serial number. And he found them in the garbage can. And they were all three winners. Yeah, but not only were they winners, they were all IRS payoffs. One of them was $900, one of them was $1,100, and one of them was $1,300. So it was like $3,300 that this kid just found in a garbage can. Now that garbage can has a higher per capita income than some third world countries. That garbage can has a higher per capita income than a family in Ecuador, for instance. Now on that same day, the same kid, he found $350 for the tickets in the men's bathroom up there. That was a good day. Now another way is just luck. Now, Joe, John, and Frank, this is a story I heard last year. Every day you get a new story. Now, Joe, John, and Frank evidently used to hang back in the day. Now, Joe and John go to the track a lot, and Frank not so much. Well, Frank evidently was going to the track with his cousin, so he called John up, and he said, "Do y'all have any horses for tomorrow?" And John said, "Yeah, we do, but Joe's got them. I don't have them. I'll have Joe call you." So Joe called Frank and left a message for him with the horses on his answering machine. Well, the two horses won. So when Joe got home that night, he had a message on his answering machine. He said, "Hey, Joe, you don't know me, but thanks for the horses." So sometimes the wrong number is the right number. Now, another way is just a confluence of things. Now, one day at Jefferson doing OTB, it was an unusual day when there was no night racing, so we were closing at 5, the last race being in California. Now, there's this young gentleman, he's in his 30s, comes out once in a while, real nice guy, bets pretty good. He just got out there for the last race, and he bet with me a bunch of trifectas and superfectas. Now, superfecta, if you don't know, is a very difficult bet to pick because it's the first four finishes in order. Now, he had bet some 11s and 12s in his combinations, and that kind of stuck in my mind, so I kind of watched the race, and both those horses were long shots. So I looked at it a little bit, and I thought he was close, so I looked to see what he had bet because he was the last person to bet with me. and he was close, but he didn't have the winners. So after the race, he told me goodbye and went by and went outside. And I got to thinking, since a superfecta is such a difficult bet to pick, sometimes nobody in the whole country, OTB, people are betting all over the country, has four winners in a row. In that case, it's the first three finishers and all. And that's what they paid off on in that particular race. So I got off my stool, ran out into the parking lot, I found him, and I asked him if he still had his tickets. And he said he did. But he said they weren't winners. I said, no. I said, I think maybe they might be. And he said, no, he insisted they were. And I said, look, I said, I think maybe. He insisted again. And finally, I said, look, I said, I really think maybe you should come in and try and see, because I think maybe they might be. So he said, well, okay. So I went back to my window, sat down, and when he got back to my window, he kept going. And went all the way in the corner, started digging around in a garbage can. Now, as Dr. Tim Ryan of UNO will tell you, every time you put a garbage can someplace in New Orleans, evidently three jobs are created. So he found him, and he comes back to me, and he says, you know, he says, I think you're wrong. He says, you know, he says, well, we'll see. So I put it in, and it was a winner. It was $1,800. He says, man, he says, you know, what kind of a tip do I give a guy like this? So he gave me $300. So about a week and a half later, he came back, and I said, hey, man, I said, how you doing? He says, okay, great. And I said, how many people have you told that story to? He said, you know, he said, that's the thing. He says, I must have told that story to 50 people. I said, that is the thing. I said, that money will be gone, but for the rest of your life, because I have that story. It's the story. It's the romance. Now, if you think it has to be a lot of money to be a story at the racetrack, let me tell you this one. The little guy's name was Smokey, about 70, 80 years old, who knows. He used to work at the Circle food store. Now, I hear that they used to call him Checkerboard around there. So that's the racetrack for, you know, guys with nicknames who have nicknames. And he was a nice little guy, and funny guy. He couldn't read. And he would ask me, he'd say, who's A-Bear riding? And he'd give me his program. And I'd tell him, he goes, I dance at your wedding. So one day he comes up to me and he says, hey man, he says, I'm running out of money here. He says, if I give you my watch, will you give me $5? And when I come out next week, I'll give you the $5 back, and you give me my watch. Well, this sounds like kind of a racetrack gambling thing, but it really doesn't happen that much, at least not to me. So it just tickled me, the whole situation, Smokey and everything. So I said, sure, Smokey. So I gave him $5, he gave me his watch, you know. So I looked at the watch and it was broken. Didn't work. So a week later, Smokey comes back. I say, Smokey, I said, I got your watch. He says, yeah, I know, I'll be back in a minute. So he comes back and he gives me the $5 and I give him his watch and he straps it on. He looks at it and he says, hey man, it don't work. And I said, yeah, I know. I said, when you gave it to me, it didn't work. He says, yeah. He says, I know, I was hoping you'd get it fixed. It's the story. It's the romance.
You're listening to Chewing a Yacht with Chris Champagne on WAMF 90.3 FM, New Orleans, Louisiana.
Now maybe a final word on a person without whom we got no game, okay? The $10 bettor. Now, he or she may be kind of wildly inconsistent. By that, I mean, you might look at him 1 minute, all right? And they looking like, there's nothing, they don't know. Okay, they know the name of an unknown soldier. You see him an hour later, okay? And they're giving you, you know, this look like, I got about as much chance of catching a winner as Elmer Fudd has of catching Bugs Bunny, right? Or 1 minute, they're spending like, 19-year-old Russian sailors on leave for the first time. See them an hour later, and they're spending like their pockets have got fish hooks in them, right? Or as they would say, old pants, new pockets. In other words, the $10 bettor, he or she is a marvel of inconsistency, right? They're sort of like a pessimistic optimist, you know? I mean, they expect to lose, but they expect to win, too. Here's a story I once heard, kind of illustrates that.
There was a guy who was a handicapper, all right? A handicapper is a guy who sells his information. This guy was good. I mean, he knew the horses. So one day he goes out to the racetrack, and there's his friend from grammar school, say St. Rose de Lima Grammar School, right? All right. His name's Eddie. Hey, Eddie, how you doing? Eddie looks like he just lost his pet gerbil or something, right? Hey, Eddie, how you doing? No good, man. He says, can't you do something for me? Please, give me something. The handicapper says, I know you, Eddie. He says, if I tell you the name of my best bet of the day, the horse I like best today, it'll be all over this track like the Asian flu. I said, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to just take my best bet of the day, and I'm going to bet $10. I'm going to buy a $10 win ticket, and I'm going to give it to you. Okay? He does that. His best bet of the day. He bets $10 for his friend Eddie. Whoosh. The horse wins like breaking sticks. And whoa. He's gone. Hands a $10 ticket to Eddie. All right? This guarantees he's going to see Eddie again. Sure enough, the next day, Eddie's owing him like white on rice, right? He does it again. He does the little $10 thing on my best bet of the day. And lo and behold, 2 days in a row, whoa, he's home. Wow. So the next day, he shows up out there, and sure enough, there's Eddie. And before the guy can say anything, Eddie says, you know, it hurts me to say this, he says. I really ain't no $10 better. So that's what we're talking about here. A lot of gratitude.
Oh, we're back here with Ronnie Virgis. Hey, Ron.
Hey, Chris.
Well, listen, you know, you're on the show all the time, and I wanted to talk a little bit about you, if you don't mind. I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. You know, when you were in school, did you always want to be a writer?
No, I think I flunked my junior year in high school.
Uh-huh.
And I got my second junior year mm-hmm. in high school. And I got a teacher that basically said, it was the first one ever said, you know, you might have a little writing talent or whatever.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
You remember a teacher's name?
Yeah. Brother Gaspar.
Okay. That's pretty interesting. You know, I failed my junior year, too.
Did you?
Yeah, I did it on purpose.
Uh-huh.
I just stopped doing anything. I passed history and PE.
Uh-huh.
I didn't flunk PE, at least. And then I did, I had two junior years. Mm-hmm. And that's my junior years when I started writing as well, really.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow, there's some coincidence.
It is, yeah. And it was on Esplanade Avenue.
Yeah, there you go, that's right.
And so were you.
Yeah, you're right.
They say all roads lead to Rome.
All roads lead to Esplanade.
Well, so once you started doing that, I mean, did you catch? Did it appeal to you right away, or did it?
I really can't say. I mean, I don't think it was like instantaneous. Oh, gee whiz!
Right.
But I guess it was the first thing I had been rewarded or praised.
Right.
Or
yeah. Well, you know, now that you mention, I mean, I didn't want this to be about me at all. I wanted to talk about you, but now that we talk about it a little bit, I mean, it's kind of me in a little bit too. I mean, I did have some teachers look at it and say something good about it, and I had friends say something good about it. But in those days, if I got praise about something, I just thought anybody could do it. You know what I mean? So I didn't really. You know, but it did get me some attention, so I guess that's one of the reasons why I did it, I suppose, too. You know, so when you went to Loyola, right?
Yeah.
Undergraduate. So at that point, had you decided that might be?
Yes.
Okay, so you went there for journalism or?
Yeah, exactly. Freshman year on.
Okay, well, that was, you know, I wanted to, well, this goes to show you how things work. I wanted to be like a sports writer at that time. But UNO had like such a crappy journalism department. It was just so small. They had maybe three journalism courses in their thing. And basically, if you took journalism one, you were automatically on the newspaper. And then there was a guy named, I think his name was Stalder.
and he and he used to write for the
sports. Yeah, I know Bob Stahl.
Yeah, and so he said, well, I got dibs in all the sports. So he wrote about all the sports. So I got to write about things like The Romance of the Rose by Jean de Meung. Some guy would come, some scholar came, and I would do that, you know. Like I could care about The Romance of the Rose by Jean de Meung, okay? So I was kind of discouraged, and I didn't have any confidence in myself anyway, so I kind of gave that up. And then I just, from then on, I majored in staying out of Vietnam. Staying out of Vietnam, yeah, that's right there. I had to take French to, you know, to graduate. So I had to take 4 semesters of French. And I remember that was like the most time-consuming thing because you had to sit there, you know, for an hour or two and try to translate the stuff.
Bonjour.
And I'd be sitting there thinking to myself, man, I don't want to do this, you know. And I'd get up to go to the bathroom, and I'd say, nah, I got to go back and sit down because I don't want to go run over to Vietnam and get my behind shot up. I remember that. But anyway, so, well, you went to the right place then, Loyola.
Yeah.
For journalism.
Yes. Yes, they were. They were good at it then, or at least had a good reputation.
Right. And who are some of the people that Orleanians would know that you went to school with over there? Can you remember any? Or were there any?
Yeah. There were a couple of, guys.
Well, if you can't remember anybody, I thought maybe there might have been some people that maybe you worked with later in town. Because I mean, I would assume that a lot of people, I might be wrong, who went to Loyola would have gone into, you know, television or in radio because they owned WWL then, right? Loyola.
Yes, they did.
So I would think they would have fed a lot of people into those places, but maybe they didn't. I don't know.
Not all that many, actually.
Really?
There was a Father Goodspeed who was the, you know, whatever else he was. He was the guy who monitored the
he was like the counselor or something like that for the journalism people.
Yeah,
that was his real name, Goodspeed.
That was his real. But actually, I mean, the main guy was a guy named Ed Fricke.
Okay.
F-R-I-C-K-E.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he had been at Loyola and had gone into the army for World War II and got his thumb shot off or whatever. And, yeah. So that's how we all remembered him, because he only had the thumb. Yeah. And he was pretty good.
Good.
Pretty good.
Well, I mean, well, you turned out pretty good, if I may say so. So I'm sure they must have had a pretty good school over there that helped you, you know, along. What was your first job when you got out, do you remember?
Oh, yeah. I immediately went into bartending.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
All right. What
no, in other words, I didn't get heavily. I take it back. It wasn't bartending. I actually had gone to it was like a PR firm, and they had three main guys and a couple of us, you know, standbys, and I did that for about a year or two, and then I went into bartending and stayed there for the next 7-8 years. Didn't actually get into thing until I was maybe late 30s, maybe.
Wow, no kidding.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't realize that. I thought maybe it had been sooner. Well, what bar do you remember? Was it one bar in particular, or just or many?
Oh, different ones. Mandina's.
Oh, wow.
But there was a place on Bourbon.
Well, that must have been a pretty good gig working at Mandina's, huh? As a bartender. That must have been pretty good money, I mean, because it was busy, huh? I mean, you know, not $1 million, but I mean, you know, if you bartended a real popular place like that,
I was just not a good bartender.
Oh, okay. Well, all right then.
No.
Yeah. I
hated to wait on people. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be a drawback.
That is a drawback.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so your first job is a newspaper was where?
First job at a newspaper. Let's see. I did. I did the horse.
Oh, okay, the horse thing.
Yes.
Oh, Racing Form.
The Racing Form. I worked for the Racing Form.
Okay, well, that was right up your alley, huh?
Yeah.
Well, that must have been I wouldn't say that would be a dream come true, but it must have been. You must have been kind of pumped about that, huh?
I liked it. Yeah, I liked it fine because I was mostly on my own.
And you liked the racetrack.
Yeah.
And you've always liked the racetrack, haven't you? So that was a pretty good gig. Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
So from that, that's how you got to work right about horse racing for the Picayune. Or was it vice versa?
Yeah, no. I did that, and then I worked, not Gambit, what was the earlier?
Figaro.
I worked briefly for Figaro, Then I worked for the Picayune. Then I worked for Gambit. And then I started working at an advanced age in television.
Television, yeah.
You've been listening to Chewing a Yacht with Chris Champagne on WAMF 90.3.